are listening to Stories from Palestine podcast, a podcast recorded in Palestine and about Palestine. My name is Crystal. I am originally from the Netherlands and I am married to a Palestinian. We live in Beit Safafa between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and we run Singer Cafe and Al Jisser Bar in Beit Sahour. Before moving to Palestine in 2013, I worked as a teacher and tour guide in the Netherlands. I have a degree in history and in tour guiding and many years of tour guiding experience. Due to the COVID pandemic, tourism in Palestine came to a complete halt, and that's why I started Stories from Palestine podcast in August 2020. This is the second year of the podcast, with every week on Monday a new episode about the history and heritage of Palestine, as well as the reality of life today. I hope you will enjoy today's episode. Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in again this week. At the moment that this podcast episode is released, we are on our way to the Netherlands. The school holidays start very early here in June, and we have been counting down to this moment to see our family and friends in the Netherlands again. So there will be a podcast break, but not just yet, because I have two episodes left that I produced for Pax Palestine podcast that I will upload for this week and for the next week. And then after that, there will be a podcast break until I return from the Netherlands to Palestine and get back in the routine. The last weeks have been pretty intense here in Jerusalem. First, of course, with the tensions on the Haram al-Sharif during Ramadan, then with the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh and the funeral that was brutally disrupted by the Israeli forces. And then last weekend, there were the Israeli settlers doing their flag parade in Jerusalem. And there have been many attacks on Palestinians, both by settlers and the army in the days after. Also, the school of the children has been closed a couple of times because there were killings of youth, especially in Al-Khadr in Bethlehem. And it's very hard for us to explain to our children that there's no school because a teenager is shot for no reason at all. He was just buying some groceries and he was on his way home. So it was really difficult weeks, and we are very happy that we have our vacation coming up. So for today and next week, I have the remaining two episodes that I recorded for Pax Palestine podcast. And then after that, there will be a summer stop. But of course, you can listen back to episodes that you've missed. And you can keep following the social media on Facebook and Instagram. I will also update you there when I'm back with new episodes. And if you are listening on a podcast player and you haven't subscribed yet, then you can subscribe or click the follow button or the bell so that you get notified when there are new episodes. I would also like to tell you about two of my favorite podcasts that you could also listen to. One of them is Jerusalem Unplugged by Roberto Mazza. He always interviews scholars and people who are historians or who are very professional on details regarding the history of Jerusalem. And then there is Preoccupation, a not-so-short history on Palestine. And I really advise you to listen to that if you want to know much more about the history of Palestine pre-Zionism and pre-the State of Israel. What has shaped the Palestinian identity? That is what you can listen to on Preoccupation. I will add a link to the show notes of this podcast so that you can easily click and go to that podcast. And now you can listen to an interview I did with Munir Nusaybe and Munir Marjia about their work with the Community Action Center in East Jerusalem. And this will give you a better understanding of all the challenges that Palestinians in Jerusalem are facing. You are listening to the Pax Palestine podcast, a podcast that features interviews with some of the local Palestinian partners of Pax, a peace organization based in the Netherlands. Pax works together with committed citizens and partners to protect civilians against acts of war, to end armed violence, and to build a just peace. In Palestine, PAX supports local partners in building resilient communities, promoting human security and equality in the political, cultural, and social domain, and in fighting the injustices resulting from the protracted occupation. My name is Crystal, and I'm your host. I am a Dutch citizen living in Palestine with my Palestinian husband and two children. Besides running a cafe and a bar in Bethlehem, I produce a weekly podcast called Stories from Palestine. Last year, I produced three episodes for PAX with interviews with local Palestinian partner organizations. And now you can listen to new episodes produced in 2022. In this episode, I interviewed Munir Nusaybe and Munir Marjia about the Community Action Center in Jerusalem. We are sitting in Jerusalem in the Via Dolorosa in Bassem's Art Gallery Cafe, who are kindly hosting us for this podcast interview. And I'm sitting here with two Munirs who are both working for the CAC, Community Action Center. Can you introduce yourself and also tell us a little bit about the CAC?
Thank you, Christelle, for having us. So my name is Munir Marjia, and I am an international advocacy officer at the Community Action Center under Al-Quds University. I studied law and psychology, and this is my academic background. And I have worked in multiple positions before starting this position. Among others, I edited content for a documentary series, and I worked with two financial companies, one that invests in startups and one that basically trades shares. So we had clients and we used to trade shares with them.
Thank you very much also. My name is Munir Nusaybe. I'm the director of the Community Action Center at Al-Quds University. I have studied law, 3 degrees of law in my life. I've focused in my studies on forcible displacement and transfer of populations because this is one of the biggest problems that are ongoing in Palestine, unfortunately, since the Nakba of 1948. And this is one of the things that I'm also dealing with in my daily work in Al-Quds University, including Community Action Center.
So can you explain more, what is the vision and the mission of the Community Action Center?
Yes, the Community Action Center is a center that was established by Al-Quds University in the Old City of Jerusalem in 1999. Al-Quds University believes that as a university, it has actually three objectives: to educate students, to promote research, and to serve the community. The Community Action Center is one of the arms of Al-Quds University in the Old City of Jerusalem that serves the community. Community Action Center envisions helping the Palestinian community in Jerusalem using a rights-based approach to try as much as possible to allow Palestinians in this city, where they are persecuted in several ways, I would say, to establish their rights or some of their rights. Unfortunately, as a result of this occupation and apartheid regime, Palestinians are unable to fulfill all of their rights as they would be able if they were free, if they were under a normal democratic system. But unfortunately, they are under occupation. They are under a regime that discriminates against them continuously, sees them as a demographic threat or a security threat, or both of them at the same time, and treats them in that way. Of course, the Jerusalemites are not unique in this compared to the rest of the Palestinian population in Israel, Palestine, or everywhere else. However, they do face unique circumstances and measures that the Israelis use against them in order to minimize their numbers as much as possible. So, Community Action Center works in two methods. On the one hand, the center provides legal aid to Palestinians using the existing illegally implemented Israeli law in the city, because the city is occupied and illegally annexed and the application of Israeli law is illegal. However, this is the only way we can get anything to a Palestinian. So we represent Palestinians before the Israeli administrative and judicial bodies in order to get whatever we can get from their rights in order to enable them to live in the city, to live in their homes, basically. And at the same time, we have our international advocacy program headed by Munir Marjieh, which works with a different standard of rights. This advocacy unit uses international law as a reference, not the Israeli law. And it appeals to the international community, asking the international community to take the measures that it is supposed to take according to international law, according to their obligations in international law, in order to provide some protection to the Palestinian population, mainly in Jerusalem, but also in many cases in other places in Palestine.
Can you maybe explain for the listeners the status of Jerusalem? We are talking about the old city of Jerusalem, where a lot of tourists come, and I think that is what most people think about. Then we know there is a West Jerusalem, there's an East Jerusalem. Israel calls it a united city, but for Palestinians, it is nothing at all united. Can you explain what is the legal status of Jerusalem and the residents of Jerusalem?
So in order to explain the legal status of Jerusalem, we should go back to the beginning of the 19th century, when Arthur Balfour signed the Balfour Declaration with Lord Rothschild, promising, according to that declaration, to establish a Jewish home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And this is the main objective of that document. Later on, in 1922, the League of Nations established the mandate over Palestine. And that was when the British mandate over Palestine started. In that covenant of 1922, the Balfour Declaration was incorporated. And then, because of the conditions of the British mandate that emboldened Jewish migration to Palestine, a lot of, like, until 1931, 100,000 Jews immigrated to Palestine. And then tensions started between the Palestinians and the Jewish community that immigrated. Jerusalem at 1931, 57% of the population of Jerusalem was Jewish because of the immigration of the Jewish people to Palestine. Tensions aggravated during the time of the mandate until May 14th, when the UK relinquished the mandate over Palestine. And that was when Israel announced the establishment of the State of Israel. But war was already going on. It stayed until the 13th of November 1948, when a UN-initiated truce came into effect. 4 months later, the armistice agreement was signed between Israel and neighboring Arab countries. I'm going to go back 2 steps backward and speak about that. Before the British mandate over Palestine ended, the UN wanted to find a solution for the two communities in Palestine, the Jewish community and the Palestinian community. The General Assembly of the UN then published resolution number 181, known also as the Partition Resolution, Partition of Palestine Resolution. According to that resolution, the area of Palestine will be divided between an Arab state and a Jewish state, and Jerusalem will be given a special status, a corpus separatum. That resolution envisaged Jerusalem demilitarized, internationalized under the supervision of the UN. A special citizenship will be given to the residents of Jerusalem. The most northern boundary of Jerusalem will be Shu'afat, the most eastern Abu Dis, the most southern Beit Lahem, and the most western Ain Karim. But what happened is that during the war, the Jewish paramilitary basically expanded or just went deep into the area allotted to the Arab state and took control of the western part of Jerusalem. And then the armistice agreement was signed. The truce came into effect, and then the armistice agreement was signed. But that had no legal effect on the validity of 181. And that's the reason why until 1967, no country established any embassy in Jerusalem. So that's what happened. In 1967, Israel waged the war, and East Jerusalem the eastern part of Jerusalem, basically, including the West Bank, was occupied. But the specific significance of the eastern part of Jerusalem is that Israel declared that this is a sovereign territory of Israel. So basically, it annexed the whole eastern part of Jerusalem. And of course, in violation of international law, very few, until today, sadly, very few countries, like a handful of countries, recognized this unlawful annexation of the eastern part of Jerusalem. But according to international law, and the most of legal scholars and the UN bodies, there are hundreds of resolutions calling on Israel to withdraw its forces from the occupied eastern part of Jerusalem. There is a consensus that this part is occupied and thus governed by the laws of belligerent occupation. So that is the status of the eastern part of Jerusalem. This is an occupied city. The western part of Jerusalem is not yet settled because the fate of that western part was determined by armed force and not international agreements. Until today, many countries look on Jerusalem and say that Jerusalem should be the capital of both states, the future independent Palestinian state and the state of Israel. But until today, it's important to mention that 9 countries still have general consulates in Jerusalem. And those general consulates report directly to the ministries of exterior affairs in their countries. And they report only for Jerusalem and what happens in Jerusalem. So many times, countries have embassies in Tel Aviv, for instance, but general consulates in Jerusalem, their mandate is Jerusalem. According to 181, they don't pay taxes for Israel, then don't receive accreditation from the president of Israel, and they keep very strict language in their protocols not to recognize any sovereign over Jerusalem as a whole.
And Munir Nusseibeh, you are from a very old Palestinian family in Jerusalem, maybe going back 1,400 years into history. So your family generations has lived here, but your status here is that you only have residency, not citizenship. Can you explain the status of the Palestinians in Jerusalem?
Yes, Israel treats us as unwanted immigrants in our own homeland and in our own ancestral land. When Israel occupied the western part of the city of Jerusalem in 1948, all of the Palestinian population that lived in that part of the city were displaced from West Jerusalem. Some of them came to East Jerusalem, some of them went to other places. So that became free of Palestinians. That part of Jerusalem became free of Palestinians until today. The eastern part of the city, when they occupied the eastern part of the city in 1967, they displaced a certain number of people in several ways, actually, in the war, after the war. They even put buses in Damascus Gate saying free travel to Jordan. So the free travel to Jordan. And many people took these buses, went to Jordan and never came back. After they finished all of that, they took a census in Jerusalem and the West Bank, the rest of the West Bank, as well as Gaza Strip. And in this census, after they annexed the eastern part of the city, in addition to some 70 kilometers square of land, which is quite big compared to the earlier Jerusalem, which was 6 kilometers square. So now Jerusalem, the new definition of Jerusalem includes a lot of villages like Beit Safafa, like Shafat, like Silwan, etc. So they annexed all of that and then they took a census. In this census, the people who lived, remained in the area were counted and then given a status of permanent resident in Israel. This is according to a law known as the Entry into Israel Law, which basically regulates visas for foreigners, all different types of visas for foreigners, you know, tourist visa, student visa, etc., and permanent residency, right? They did a similar thing in the West Bank and Gaza. They also gave people a residency status in the West Bank and a residency status in Gaza. And over time, they revoked that residency status from the West Bank and Gaza, 250,000 people, and in Jerusalem until the current day, 14,600 people have had their residences revoked. But I will focus now on Jerusalem, our topic. This residency status is very different from citizenship. Despite the fact that they annexed the land of Jerusalem, they did not annex the people of Jerusalem. And the residency status is revocable. And as time has been going on since the occupation until today, Israel has been only developing the methods according to which they can revoke the residency status. So in the 70s, Palestinians' residency status would be revoked if he or she remained for 7 years outside the country, abroad, totally abroad, or if they got a permanent residency in another country or a citizenship in another country. If any of these three conditions were fulfilled, the Palestinian would lose their residency status. They would revoke the residency status. Then the peace process came. But the peace process, unfortunately, did not guarantee stopping the forcible displacement of Palestinians in any way, and did not guarantee stopping the settlements and stopping a lot of crimes that were ongoing from the time before the peace process started. And surprisingly enough, Israel started speeding up the methods of revoking residences from Palestinians after the peace process. Instead of the three criteria that I just mentioned that were written in an ordinance, official ordinance, they started revoking residency statuses from Palestinians without, of course, any declaration or any announcement of anything like that. They started revoking residences based on a new criterion that they invented at the time called the center of life. So if your center of life is not in Israel, according to their definition of Israel, then your residency will be revoked. And during that period, they started considering all the Palestinian Jerusalemites who are living in the rest of the West Bank or Gaza as people who have moved their center of life abroad and therefore started revoking their residency statuses in masses. So in that period, Palestinians started discovering that their residency have been revoked. Of course, they didn't even inform you that your residency had been revoked. And this is as a result of a Supreme Court decision by a famous judge known as Aharon Barak, who said that it's not even just a revocation. If you move your center of life to outside Israel, your residency expires by itself. So he gave the opportunity to the Ministry of Interior to even refrain from telling you that they are considering revoking your residency or that you have to do something in order to protect yourself. So people, when they went to renew an ID card or a travel document or to register a new child that was born, discovered suddenly that they are not residents anymore, because of this criterion of center of life. So this is one of the things that actually our center deals with a lot. We are helping people to prove until today, you know, we're 2022 now, but still helping people to prove that their center of life is in Jerusalem in order to protect their legal status. And the level of bureaucracy that people have to go through in order to prove the center of life, especially if they have a house in the West Bank or they lived for a certain period of time in the West Bank, is huge. They always have to collect documents. This is now the Jerusalemite is a person who will never throw a water bill or an electricity bill or a certificate of their children in school, because all of these documents are going to be needed in the Ministry of Interior, certainly, but maybe in court someday, right? So the Palestinians always have, in Jerusalem, always have folders where they save every document, every bill that they pay. Some people have even, you know, our lawyers said some people have even kept receipts of restaurants and shopping and things like that, even though that's not necessary, in fact. But, you know, people now became afraid. They are all the time just collecting documents and walking around, and when they want to renew something, with suitcases full of documents in order to show the Ministry of Interior that they are living here. And the Ministry of Interior have given themselves access to not only the electricity system in Jerusalem, which they supervise, but also in the West Bank. So if you have two houses, one in the West Bank and one in Jerusalem, they will compare the electricity bills in both. So if you spend more electricity in the West Bank, the Ministry of Interior will consider that your center of life is in the West Bank. So people now make sure that they spend electricity, if they have two houses or two dwellings, they spend more electricity in Jerusalem. They keep the lights on, they open air conditioning, maybe the tap, sometimes they keep it a little bit open in order to make sure that their consumption of water in Jerusalem is higher than the consumption of water in the West Bank. And this is the life of the Jerusalemite. And this is only to be able to live in their own houses. Another big problem related to residency status is the child registration problem. And this is a problem that has been facing Palestinians and has left many children, some of whom have grown up to adulthood with no legal status. So according to the Israeli legal system and the center of life policy and all of that, and because the residency status is not a citizenship, we don't pass it automatically to our children. Passing your residency status to your children needs to go through also a very complicated bureaucracy in many cases. Only if both parents are permanent residents and their residency is continuing to be applicable, then the child will get a birth certificate and a number of ID card in the hospital. But if one of the parents is not a permanent resident, maybe from the West Bank, maybe from Gaza, maybe from abroad, then the children will not automatically get the status, and the family will have to go through a bureaucracy in order to show that this child is actually living here, that the child is, the family is living here, and that their center of life is in Israel. Now, some families fail to prove that on time, and children grow up with no legal status. And while the children are children, life seems okay somehow, but then they grow up. And then the soldiers start and the policemen start asking them for ID cards. And then they grow up and they become adults. And once they become adults, the family can do nothing about them. They cannot even give them a residency status. In fact, if these children are considered to be West Bank residents, the maximum age that you can actually apply for registration or family unification to them is 14. So if you do not apply before the age of 14, and you don't succeed in that process, that's it, you've lost. And there are thousands of children, we don't know their number exactly, in Jerusalem who have no registration, no legal status whatsoever. I'm not saying stateless, because I am stateless. I have no citizenship, I am stateless, right? So I'm not saying stateless, I'm saying a term that we invented, statusless. Right? It's a term that we, I don't think exists somewhere else. We had to invent it because no legal status. This child does not live legally anywhere on the planet. In his ancestral land, this child has no legal status, and now some of them have become adults. So they live in the city, they walk in the streets, they try to work. Of course, this means that they don't carry an ID card. If you don't carry an ID card, what does it mean? It means that you cannot do anything. You cannot open a bank account. You cannot cash checks. You cannot prove who you are. It means that you have to carry on your life and all of the details of your life illegally, in everything, in every way. You have to work illegally to get money illegally, to spend money illegally, everything. No health insurance, no welfare. Of course, if you're a child, you're not entitled to schooling, to free schooling, right? Because you don't exist. I mean, you exist as a human being, but you don't exist in the legal sense. So you get nothing. You get no services, and life goes on. We know many examples of that, some of whom have become adults, and now they are adults walking around and doing things, but you cannot drive a car, of course. You cannot travel. You cannot go abroad because you have no document to use to go abroad. And this is the situation that people are dealing with. So our center, one of the things we do is that we try as much as possible to help families in order to be able to register their children as early as possible. Because if they miss the opportunity, we know that their children will suffer for the rest of their lives. In addition to that, there is an additional problem related to residency, which is family unification. Israel has created discriminatory laws that prevent Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza from getting a permanent status in what it considers to be Israel. People have to continue applying for family unification and to renew a permit, a temporary permit that they get if they succeed for indefinitely, basically. And therefore, they continue to go to the Ministry of Interior and we help people with that. However, this compared to the Jewish experience in the city is totally different. I mentioned, for example, residency revocation. You know, all the Jewish population in the city are citizens. Their status is not revocable. But not only that. According to Israeli law, a Jewish child born in Israel becomes a citizen automatically. Right? According to the law of return. So even if a tourist, a Jewish tourist couple are just coming for tourism, for a visit, and they have a child here, even if they are not citizens, they are on a tourist visa, their child becomes a citizen. And of course, every Jew around the world has the right, according to the Israeli law, to immigrate to Israel and become a citizen and get all the rights, all the entitlements, all the housing help and everything. The Palestinian experience is very different. This is apartheid.
That's quite shocking, because it seems that the policies of the Israeli government and the municipality of Jerusalem is really towards supporting Jewish life in Jerusalem and getting rid of Palestinian life in Jerusalem. And we hear all these stories about residency, but what we also hear very often is stories about home demolitions, about people's livelihood really being removed from the city. Can you give us a little bit of insight in why and how these home demolitions happen? Because I have heard people say, well, if you build a house without a permit, then yeah, you get a punishment. But what is the situation in Jerusalem? Why do people build homes without permits? And what kind of laws does Israel use in order to get these people out of their homes?
So before diving into that question, I would like to clarify the Israeli policies in Eastern Jerusalem. So since its occupation in 1967, Israel established two main objectives to lead all policies with regard to the eastern part of Jerusalem. The first is to ensure that the eastern part of Jerusalem will stay under Israeli sovereignty. And the second objective is maintaining and controlling the demographic composition of the city. And that is very important because at the beginning, at the early years after the occupation, they decided a ratio between Palestinians and Jews. And then they understood that they cannot really realize this ratio because the Palestinian population is growing more than expected and the Jewish population is growing less than planned. So they needed to intervene in order to keep controlling this demographic composition. The latest determination of demographics in Jerusalem was in 2011. The Israeli authorities published the outline plan 2000, according to which until the year 2020, the demographic ratio between Arabs and Jews should not precede 60-40. 60% Jews, 40% Palestinians. And that's an objective, that's an official objective, controlling demographics. We know that demographics are a function of mortality rates, relocation, birth, but in Jerusalem it's not. In Jerusalem it is supervised, it is very crucial in order to keep and maintain the Jewish character of Jerusalem. Why demolitions happens, to your question? Since the occupation, the population Palestinian grew, but no lands were given to Palestinians to build on. Today we are living in a situation where 13% of the land of the eastern part of Jerusalem is designated for Palestinians to build on. And the majority of this land is occupied with buildings already. So where people will go? There's no place to go to. They need to build. They need to find housing for themselves and for their families. On the other hand, 35% of the land in the eastern part of Jerusalem was confiscated by Israel, illegally, of course, and reallocated for building dwellings and Jewish neighborhoods for Jewish immigrants to live in. Today, we are living in a situation where 220 illegal Israeli settlers live in the eastern part of Jerusalem illegally, according to international law, and 370,000 Palestinians live on 30% of the land. Palestinians have no other chance except for building. In order to build, they need to receive an Israeli-issued building permit, which is really hard to receive because the land in the eastern part of Jerusalem is, according to Israeli laws, because all this is happening within the framework of Israeli laws. Although it's illegal, but this is the situation. That's the factual situation. In order to receive an Israeli-issued building permit, there are preconditions for that. Part of those preconditions are that the land will be registered and the final land title settlement should be also settled, which doesn't exist in Jerusalem until today, although we know that things are changing badly, but we'll discuss that in a moment. So, Palestinians built. Many times demolition happened because, according to the Israeli municipality of Jerusalem, Palestinians built on an area designated as a green area, not suitable for building. It's very important to mention that one third of the houses in the eastern part of Jerusalem are in the risk of being demolished because one third housing approximately 120,000, 130,000 Palestinians. Those are houses that are built without an Israeli issued building permit. And that's why we witness monthly, sometimes tens of houses demolished. Of course, displacing the whole family, women, children. It's one of the biggest humanitarian crises in eastern Jerusalem, honestly, the demolitions.
Can I add something here?
Yeah, sure.
So as he described, Israel has zoned the city in a way that prevented Palestinians from building in their own lands, only encouraging Jewish-Israeli construction, which is done usually by big companies and by the state itself, whereas the Palestinians would want to build their own houses on their own lands, of course. But the zoning has prevented that. Palestinians, if they leave the city, And if they go somewhere else where they can actually build and, you know, live a normal life, most probably their residences would be revoked. Because if you go to the West Bank, if you go somewhere else, then you will lose your residency. You have no option. You have no option. You cannot go anywhere. You have to stay in Jerusalem, which means you have to build a new house. If you, you know, people are growing in numbers. We cannot stay in the same houses that existed in 1967, despite the fact that the zoning policy has basically kept the situation as it is since 1967, right? So people have to build, and they have to do that, because if they leave, they will lose their residency, their children will lose their residency, and life will become much more complicated. So you have to face a situation where you will have to breach one Israeli law or another because the laws are not allowing you to do anything else.
How does that go if you receive a letter from the municipality that you've built your house without a permit and now we are going to demolish that?
Well, they give you the option of demolishing the house by yourself, cynically. They tell
you. It's not a letter, by the way. It's a criminal offense in the Israeli law. Sorry for interrupting you, but it's not a letter. It's a file in the court, in the municipal court. So you are a defendant and they are accusing you of building without a permit or living in a house without a permit. And according to them, one of the remedies of this is that you demolish it yourself. Or the main remedy is that you demolish it yourself. And then if you refuse, you will continue. Sorry.
Yeah. Thanks, Munir. So yeah, either you demolish it or they will come and demolish it. But that's the thing. If they will come and demolish it, you're going to pay that demolition. And that demolition will cost you approximately 100,000 Israeli shekels, which is approximately $33,500.
So basically they tell you, if we come to demolish it, we have to bring these machines and workers and some security personnel and you pay for it. Yeah. And if you want to avoid paying that amount of money, then you just have to come with a sledgehammer and just destroy the house that you built with your own hands. We've heard in the news over the past years a lot about Sheikh Jarrah, especially because there is these twins, Mohammed and Muna Al-Kur, that are really good on social media. And I think they have opened a lot of people's eyes for situations that are happening in the Old City of Jerusalem. That is a little bit another case, because there we are talking about a Jewish claim on the house of the people who live there. Can one of you explain the situation of that family?
Basically, in the 70s, in the 1970s, there was an Israeli right-wing settler group that basically filed a case in the Israeli courts saying that the land on which the Kurd family and other families as well are living on used to be owned by Jews before 1948, and therefore they had the right to evict these people from the houses, which is actually allowed by the Israeli law in this case. So the Palestinians at the time used the services of an Israeli lawyer, because at the time there was a general strike of Palestinian lawyers and they didn't want to deal with the Israeli system and all of that. So, and the Israeli lawyer apparently made an oral agreement with the settler organization that was in the court, according to which they would recognize that this land is owned by the settler group, but at the same time, the Palestinian inhabitants of these houses would be considered protected tenants. Of course, these Palestinians are refugees from West Jerusalem and from what became Israel in 1948. They had been forcibly displaced, and then Jordan and the United Nations, the UNRWA, built them these houses as, you know, a dwelling for them after they had been displaced. And because they were houses and not a refugee camp, the UNRWA agreed with them that they would take and revoke the card that entitles them to refugee services, which includes medical care, food aid, all different types of services that the UNRWA provides for these houses. So that's what happened. They lived in these houses since 1956 and then continued to live there until the settler organization started claiming the land and that agreement happened. Now, in 2008 or 2007, the settler organization started filing cases again for evicting these protected tenants, as they considered them, using several claims. One claim was they are not paying rent. Now, when asked, the population said, we never even knew that we had to pay rent. We didn't know that we are considered protected tenants. To whom should we pay rent? Nobody ever came and asked us to pay rent. So they even said that they didn't know about that agreement that happened in the court with Advocate Cohen at the time. So one of the reasons was that they were not paying rent. Another reason was some of them added a room here, a kitchen there, something like that, without the permit of the owner, as they claimed. So during that period, I think in 2009, four families were evicted from them, their houses, forcibly displaced, of course, according to international law, according to Israeli law, evicted from their houses. During that period, a lot of solidarity was expressed, and there was a tent that was put in the Sheikh Jarrah community where people used to express solidarity and all of that. It's four families. Okay. Now, during this period, there have been always ongoing cases in the court. And the communities have lost a lot of cases in the Israeli courts, which was an indication that soon, in 2021, it was seen that soon other families would be displaced from their homes. Basically, the way the settlers work is they don't sue everybody at the same time. They are testing. So they go for four families in one way, four other families in a different way. So it's a, you know, strategic thing. And of course, they have a lot of money and they have the support of the state and they have all that. So, you know, they have time also. They believe they have time. I hope not. But until now, it's evident that they have time and they are trying all the experiments to see how they can evict people from their homes. Recently, actually, the Israeli court has decided, and I think we can give a lot of credit for this decision to the Sheikh Jarrah communities raising their voices and creating all the fuss around their houses. Because I've also seen the lawyer and talked to the lawyers working there. They said, look, I have a lot of evidence that shows that these settlers don't own the land. The problem was that the Israeli courts did not want to discuss ownership at all. They just wanted to work with the case as if these people are tenants and these people are landlords, and that's the relationship. They didn't want to go into examination of ownership. The main lawyer who is representing these families is saying, no, please allow me, that's his request, allow me to argue for who owns this land. I have a lot of documents. He has actually done a lot of research. He has gone to the Ottoman archives. He has gone to the court archives of the 1800s and 1900s and, you know, and he has documents that he can show, which show that this land is not owned by these settlers. So finally, and I think really thanks, because usually we lose these cases, but finally, the court has said, okay, no evictions until the ownership is settled, until we know who owns this land. So this is a very recent, a very recent decision concerning the eastern part of Sheikh Jarrah, this specific community. Of course, there are other areas in Sheikh Jarrah that are still facing similar concerns, and the Israeli authorities have demolished a house recently and evicted a family, demolished also a nursery. Yeah. So the Sheikh Jarrah problem is not over, but I think the Palestinian inhabitants of the houses who continue to live there have bought some time in that area, at least the four families that have gotten a court decision.
So when we hear all these stories about how they are trying to get Palestinians in Jerusalem out of their homes and out of the city, what are the laws that they are using, and what is it that you can do to support people?
So there are two stages that should be examined regarding the laws that are implemented in Eastern Jerusalem. I want to speak mainly about two laws. The first one is the absentee property law from 1950, and then the legal and administrative matters ordinance from 1970. The first law started after the establishment of the State of Israel in the form of regulations to regulate the administration of abandoned properties. So during the Nakba, 850,000 Palestinians were expelled or fled from their houses, and they left a lot of properties behind. And when I say properties, I speak about orchards, I speak about houses, furniture, but also, you know, the most intimate and sincere things like books, bank accounts. So Israel started designing a law bit by bit in order to confiscate and then reallocate those properties to the new Jewish immigrants. So it was a two-step process. at the beginning confiscating the properties and then reallocating them to Jewish immigrants. So that law is still in effect until today. According to that law, any person who was in a, well, they mentioned there are six Arab countries, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, countries basically that were in war with Israel. Any person who live in those countries and he's the legal owner of property in historical Palestine in Israel, when it became Israel, his property will be transferred to the custodian of absentee property. So basically all the Palestinian refugees, the Palestinian community who lives today in exile, are absentees vis-a-vis their properties in historical Palestine, what became Israel. And we know that the UN Security Council passed a resolution, Resolution 194, stating that those Palestinian refugees have the right to come back to their houses if they wish to live in peace with their neighbors. And if they don't want that, Israel must pay them compensation for the properties they lost. Of course, that resolution establishes the right of return of Palestinians, and it is still in effect until today, although no one enforces it, sadly. That was the absentee property law. It is implemented in East Jerusalem because after the occupation of the eastern part of Jerusalem in 1967, Israel applied its laws over the newly conquered territory, and they enacted a law which gives Jews and only Jews the right to claim for properties they were linked to before 1948. And that is very important because we are not speaking about ownership in the traditional sense that we know today. Okay, according to that law, the general custodian will take properties that belong to the custodian of enemy property, which was the Jordanian custodian, because also Jews lived in the eastern part of Jerusalem. So if you go back two steps again, there were approximately 2,000 Jews living in the eastern part of Jerusalem and 60,000 Palestinians living in the western part of Jerusalem. And because of the Nakba, that 2,000 Jewish residents back then of the eastern part of Jerusalem moved to the western part of Jerusalem. They received back then houses from the state of Israel, and they were compensated for the houses that they lost their linkage to. And the 60,000 Palestinians, of course, lost also their everything, basically. At 1970, when Israel enacted that law, it gave only Jews the right to claim for property rights in the eastern part of Jerusalem, and not for Palestinians. It's exclusively for Jews. Back then, Jews lived in eastern Jerusalem according to a different set of property rights, which were basically Ottoman, the majority of them, and short-term lease, long-term rent, like any linkage to a property was then interpreted by the Israeli Supreme Court as full ownership. So basically, this is the basis of the settler activity in eastern Jerusalem today. Settler associations tried to allocate those properties that Jews were linked to before 48 and then go to the Israeli courts and demand that they will receive those properties back. Those are mainly the two laws that are in effect when we speak about Ateret Kohanim, when we speak about El Ad, when we speak about those settler associations. They function under the auspices of those two laws. Those two laws were basically designed for that purpose, for giving properties to Jews and taking properties from Palestinians.
So now my main question is, how can you help and support local Palestinian residents from Jerusalem when we see that all of this is going on? How does your center support people practically?
Our center supports people in two different ways. First, we, according to the applicable Israeli law, which is applicable illegally in international law because it's an occupied territory. However, according to this law, we serve people before the Israeli administrative and judicial authorities. So we help Palestinians to prove, for example, their center of life. We represent Palestinians accused of building without a permit, trying as much as possible to cancel the demolition order, although in most cases, in our center and in other similar centers, what we consider a success is postponing the demolition. So you keep postponing and then the Palestinian will have to pay very expensive fines, hundreds of thousands of shekels and dollars, in order to just keep the house undemolished. But they have no other option. It's not like they can demolish it and buy a house somewhere else. You know, there are no houses to buy. So we help with that. Our lawyers are meeting with beneficiaries every day. We have an open door policy call it storefront. So people will just come in without an appointment. Of course, some people will make an appointment for a bigger procedure or something like that. But people will come in, tell us their problems, and then we will see how we can help them. So our lawyers are helping people with, you know, the social welfare system, with the residency status, with the family unification. Hundreds of Palestinians come per year in order to get our services. In some cases, usually more than 1,000 will come per year to get our services on all these. And our services are totally free. We don't charge anything. In some cases, we even pay the court fees for Palestinians, especially when we feel that this family, you know, cannot afford that. By this, we don't establish justice, because justice is impossible under the current regime. However, at least we help people to survive. We save them tens of thousands of dollars that they would pay to private lawyers. Lawyers in Jerusalem charge a lot of money because, first, there is a lot of need and people really need to survive and they have no other option. It's not an optional thing to be represented in a court, so people will have to do it. And the procedures are really complicated and you continue working and sometimes the cases don't end. If a family unification case, it never ends. You have to apply every year for a permit and all of that. So we help people in that way. And we believe that this is important and this is an important service. The other way we believe is probably more important strategically is our international advocacy program. Because yes, we are helping people according to this law, but this law is illegal in international law. It is unfair. And we need to make sure that this status quo changes. Cannot continue living under these circumstances. We believe that we are human beings like every other human being in the world and that we are entitled to the rights that other human beings in the world are entitled to. And therefore, our struggle needs to not only be within the Israeli legal circles, but within the international legal circles. The international community and the different states in the world have signed and ratified a lot of conventions that create obligations for them. These conventions don't only create obligations for two conflicting states like the current situation, you know, Palestine, Israel, but they also create obligations for other states who are expected, especially in cases of war crimes, crimes against humanity, severe human rights violations and international humanitarian law violations. These states are expected to stop. Look at what happened now in Russia and Ukraine. We saw that the Western world very quickly acted and very decisively started after 5 days of the conflict. They started implementing sanctions on Russia, which is their obligation, of course. They are expected to apply sanctions on Russia. That's what they should do. A state cannot just go invade another country and occupy it and annex territory. And, you know, that's what they should do. We haven't seen something similar in Palestine. And this is because most of the Western world, which is the powerful part of the world, which is the wealthy part of the world, which is the effective part of the world, sees Israel as an ally. And we appeal to that part of the world through our advocacy unit, trying to show the facts and to ask these states to vote in a certain way, to consider certain principles. Unfortunately, this part of our job is very frustrating because you see a diplomat, you talk to a diplomat. In many cases, the diplomat knows that you are right and tells you, I think you are right, what you're saying is right. But unfortunately, our Minister of Exterior has instructed us to vote differently. We cannot vote in this way. Right, I'm being abstract, I'm not mentioning specific names, not specific countries. But this is something that we see quite frequently. They know that international law expects them to do something. But at the end of the day, these decisions are taken in the capitals. And the capitals, even if the population is sympathetic with human rights, they don't act in that way. They act according to what they believe is their strategic interest. And I don't know how the Western world, that has been advocating for democracy for a long time in the world and advocating for human rights, and they still advocate for human rights, even in Palestine, when we interact with them, we always talk about human rights and women's rights and gay rights and all different types of rights. Of course, that's great, important. But why don't you do your obligations according to these laws? This is a question that frustrates us all the time. But despite the fact that it is frustrating us, we believe that we should continue doing that for several reasons. On the one hand, if we don't say anything, then we should be okay, right? So if we're not okay, we should say something. So we should continue to talk and to communicate the injustices. On the other hand, only through persistent work, I think things can change. We saw the Western world in South Africa. They were very supportive of the apartheid regime initially. But then at some point, they discovered that they were wrong and they changed the way they acted. I believe that this is something that will happen at some point here in Palestine, if the circumstances allow that. And we should make them allow that at the end of the day. But also, our documentation of human rights violations, which we do in the advocacy unit, and our communication to the world is also a documentation of this period. We will be free one day, that's for sure. I don't have any doubt that we will be free. It's impossible for an injustice like that to continue forever. Yes, they can lie today, they lied yesterday, they will lie tomorrow, that will be the case. But one day, the circumstances will allow freedom, according to one reason or the other, right? I don't know how, but it will happen. When this happens, it will be time for transitional justice. We will have to design methods to address the injustices that happened in the past. So this is what happened in many countries around the world. The term transitional justice is basically about methods that happen after an injustice in order to address this injustice or many injustices, usually after regime changes and after occupation finishes or, you know, and all of that. We have many, many examples in the world. So what we're doing today is also informing the future, right? So now we are documenting and we are making our legal arguments. Yes, we are unable to protect ourselves today. We are too weak for that. And the world works in a double standard way and doesn't listen enough. And diplomacy is corrupt. But I believe that in the future, this will change. Otherwise, I will not continue working. You know, I will do something else if I don't believe that. So I believe that it will happen and that then we will inform, our work today informs whoever will do, if it's us. If this happens in our lifetime, then it will inform us about how to address the injustices. And if we die before the justice, then it will inform the next generation about what they should do. But it will happen. So that's important what we're doing today. I think it's really important.
There's also one important thing. The impunity that Israel enjoys is the only framework that Israel functions within. Russia is almost isolated today. And we can see that hypocrisy of the Western world. I will go back to 1967. In the wake of the occupation of the eastern part of Jerusalem, when Israelis entered the old city and said, it is in our hands today. There was a debate among Israeli officials. What will happen? How the international community will react? And they were discussing Israelis among themselves. We were reviewing the protocols of the meetings. They were discussing by themselves, by their initiative, internationalizing the old city. And then the decision came. If the international community will act, we will consider that. And the reluctance of the international community, the lack of action, contributed very much to that situation.
The last question for this podcast interview. You are the advocacy officer. You are the one who is responsible for sharing the story of the Jerusalemites with the world. You also cooperate with Pax, who asked us to make this podcast. What is it that you see that the international community can do? What do you want from the international community? And how do you envision a change that may happen to Jerusalem?
What I expect from the international community is immediate action. And immediate action to create pressure on Israel to stop its institutionalized regime of discrimination and oppression against the Palestinians, which according to a lot of human rights organizations today, locally and globally, amounts to the crime against humanity of apartheid. Those sanctions that I expect from the international community to impose on Israel, I believe that they can pressure Israel to back off all the actions that it takes against Palestinians. So pressure through sanctions. Sanctions are crucial in order to affect, influence the situation that is ongoing since 72 years. I mean, this is the longest occupation in history, like recent history. Nothing is happening. So sanctions, focusing on sanctions.
I wish you both very much luck with the work you are doing. And hopefully a lot of people are listening and have become interested in learning more. I will add a link to the show notes of this podcast episode to your website and your social media accounts so that they can learn more and read more and follow you there. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you so much, Crystal. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Stories from Palestine. If you enjoy the podcast, then here are several things you can do to support the show. Tell your friends about the podcast. Share some of the social media posts on Instagram or Facebook. Start following the YouTube channel. You can also hear the podcast audio there. And soon I will start uploading videos. Sign up for the email list so that you get a reminder with a clickable link to the new podcast episode. And in the future, you will be updated about programs and trips that I will start to organize. And of course, you can donate to help me pay for hosting the podcast and the website and all the related recording costs. It's the only source of income I have at the moment, so you can imagine how much I appreciate every cup of coffee or falafel sandwich that you buy me on the Ko-fi platform. All the links that you need can be found in the show notes and on the website storiesfrompalestine.info. That's it. I hope you will tune in again next week.